Hey, podcasting softly. My guest today is my good buddy David J. Moore. We're talking about his wonderful. He's a for the uninitiated. He's a publicist. He's a film writer, all round gentleman. We're talking about his contribution to this wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. Absolutely can't wait to get my hands on it because I'm a huge, huge, huge nut for this movie. The movie is Waterworld. Arrow is releasing a wonderful package, Blu-ray release. It's got three versions of the movie, plus a wonderful documentary by Daniel Griffith. We're hoping to talk to Daniel at some point about that. But we're talking to David today because he has contributed to a wonderful insert booklet for which he was a contributing author. David, thank you for being on Podcasting Softly, and thank you for being part of this wonderful, finally wonderful, beautiful release of this movie that we both love, evidently.
Yeah, no, this is great. I think I was approached because I'm a huge fan of this movie, so I'm just honored to be a part of it. Thank you for having me.
Yes. So, you obviously, like me, would have seen Waterworld when it first came out in the cinema, yeah?
Oh, yeah. I believe I saw it twice in July of 95. Yeah.
It was still awesome. I hate to say it sometimes, that it's not that I dislike it when it comes home, but it's definitely one of those movies that really benefits from seeing it on the big screen. It's a real big screen movie, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. You know, luckily I live near Los Angeles, and we have some repertory theaters out here that show older films on the big screen in 35mm, and I've seen almost everything that I've wanted to see again or for the first time in 35mm, but for some reason no one has shown Waterworld theatrically since 1995 out here, because I've been looking out for it.
Yeah.
So I can't wait to see it again in a theater, because it was made to be seen on a big screen.
Yeah, definitely. Now, I saw it when it first came out. It was a huge, it was a summer movie over there, which means it's a winter movie over here. But it was at the time, it was at one of the biggest theaters I'd ever been in. Huge theater, huge screen, long before that was sort of popular. Now with a lot of the multiplexes, they have these big screens and lots of seats, uh-huh. But this was like a big theater. And my resounding memory is how much my mother hated the movie, because we were away at the Gold Coast as a family, and we'd done a bit of shopping and stuff. Let's go see a movie. And, okay, you picked the movie, and so I picked Waterworld because it, was the only thing that looked good and was starting soon. And so we went in, and all I remember was I remember how much I love it, but I remember fondly my mother's contempt when she came out. She's going, "Oh, my God." She said, "That's 2 hours of my life I'll never get back." Did you enjoy that? And I said, "Yes, didn't you like it, Mum?" No, she said, "Oh my God, from the start he pissed in a cup and drank it. That's terrible." And I said, "No, he didn't piss into a cup and drink it. He pissed into a thing and he made it drinkable. Oh, that's disgusting. It's terrible." And so she's always had like this weird, like, she only ever saw it the once, but she was like, "Oh God, this is bloody rotten. It's just like Mad Max on water." I said, "That's the idea. It is Mad Max on water." But anyway, not to be sidetracked, I absolutely, completely and utterly blown away, and been hanging out. I always had this dream, but Daniel's beaten me to it, was to make it the definitive sort of documentary about the making of Waterworld, get everyone back, get everyone interviewed. But he's beaten me to the punch, and God love him for it, because this is a wonderful release. So certainly you were contacted to write the piece, and I believe you were also responsible for some of the the other materials, like the reprints of the cards and whatever you get with it, lobby cards or
Yeah. So Daniel Griffith, the producer of the release, he had contacted me on Twitter out of the blue. You know, I didn't know who he was, nothing. And I got this random message on Twitter, and he said, hey, I'm a big fan of your book, World Gone Wild, The Survivor's Guide to Post-Apocalyptic Movies. And I'm the producer on this upcoming release for Waterworld, the definitive Blu-ray release from Arrow. He was wondering if I would be interested in doing, writing the essay in the booklet about the film.
Right.
And I said, wow, okay, I would love to. Why did you choose me? And he saw in my book that I was a huge, huge fan of Waterworld. You know, I wrote a glowing review of Waterworld, and I gave it my highest rating, which I feel is, at the time when the book came out, was a very unpopular opinion. You know, the movie has been shunned and looked down upon for years, you know. And I've always felt like I was a champion of the movie. So, but then I didn't hear anything back for months and months. I thought that he just kind of, you know, forgot about me or whatever. So I was like, bummer, whatever. But then I got contacted by Arrow and got the ball rolling. And I delivered my essay in, I think it was 48 hours. You know, they gave me like 40 days and I delivered it 2 days later.
Wow.
I have a wealth of appreciation for this movie, and I couldn't wait to write it. You know, I love this movie. There's lots to talk about with this movie. And I've always been good with deadlines. I mean, if you give me a deadline, I'll turn it in right away. You know, I've always been like that. So when I submitted my essay, which they accepted right away, they said, this is great. You know, we're going to publish it as is. I also sent them as a bonus just because I had some. I had scans of some. I think they were British or Spanish or French lobby cards. I don't know what country they're from. But I used images of the lobby cards in my book, and I had them. So I sent them to Arrow. I thought, hey, I've got these scans. If you're interested, you know, here you go. I didn't ask for anything, or I just sent them. And so they loved the images. They wanted me to go to they wanted me to get them professionally scanned in, which because I just scanned them off of my own scanner, which is, you know, it's good for smaller things, but they wanted really high quality. So I had to go to a professional place and scan the stuff so that they could use them. And they did. They used, I think, 6 of them out of, I think I had 12, and they only used 6 of them.
Right. That's great. That's fantastic.
And they put them in the collection, so you know they're like little postcards.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm it's a film I like. I'm a bit of a nut. You know, I went out and bought the soundtrack and the toys and the books and the video game and all that sort of stuff. And now it's like this weird. You know, when people see that stuff, you know, on my desk or shelf or wherever, they're like, it's sort of like a, it's almost like it's a great conversation piece, you know, like where they made merchandise for Waterworld, and
yeah,
and it's
well, back then they merchandised all those movies, you know, like the Shadow and the Phantom and Dick Tracy, you know, like the 90s, there was a huge market for that stuff. They were trying to make a buck by making toys and video games and all of that. I mean, No Escape had a Super Nintendo game. I mean, or Absalom or whatever it's called abroad, you know, the Ray Liotta movie.
So,
yeah, I mean, Waterworld had a ton of stuff. I have the comic books. I have the board game, which I played with my buddies. It's a fun little board game.
Yeah.
What else? Of course, I bought the soundtrack. Huge fan of the score by James Newton Howard.
Yeah.
And, there was a lot of stuff. I wish there were more toys and more spin-off novels of what happens to the Mariner, you know?
Yeah.
But I guess the cult following wasn't as feverish as it could have been, you know.
Yeah. So, I mean, the thing that they often talk about when this film's brought up is they usually talk about the great excesses more than the great, you know, successes, you know. They talk about the, you know, the fact that the set sunk and had to be refloated, and the $40,000 a day yacht or something that Kevin Costner had to ferry him out to the set and back, which was only supposedly 200 yards away from where he was staying or something like that, you know.
Yeah.
They talk about the great hubris of it more than the great elements of it. Do you feel that way?
I do, but the great thing about Waterworld is that it's aged remarkably well. When you look at it now, because I watched it again the other night, and I watched the 3-hour European version, and then I watched the 2-hour documentary. The movie just looks fantastic. It looks amazing. The only thing that I would say is a little bit of a detriment is the underwater CGI. That's the only thing that I can kind of point at and say, you know, that looks a little dated. But other than that, I mean, that's easily forgivable. The movie just, it's an astounding work of hard work. You can tell that they put an incredible amount of labor into this movie. The sets are incredible. That trimaran that Costner rides around in, it's just, you know, it's breathtaking. The scenery looks great. Dean Semler's cinematography is just, you know, fantastic. I mean, the movie really resembles a pirate film, you know, like Errol Flynn type movie.
Yes,
it has a really gigantic scope. It's just, there's nothing quite like it. It's just incredible looking.
Yeah, no, it's, for me, it's always been like, this movie felt like the last, or one of the last, you know, big Hollywood movies with sets. You know, there's very little, probably, or to no green screen stuff in it. Like, that, it's pretty incredible to think that the atoll at the start where the big battle occurs is a working set. It's built, it's there. It's not, you know, it's not like there's just the walls on the outside for the outside, and then you go into, like, you know, traditional Hollywood, the interior is a set on a soundstage somewhere. No, this thing is actually out there floating in the ocean, and it's fully constructed. And,
oh, yeah.
And it's just, to think of the scale of that, like, you know, it's hard sometimes sitting in a movie theater watching something, and of course the scale is ominous because it's there on a giant screen in front of you. But I often think of a story told me by the writer of Event Horizon. I can't think of his name off the top of my head. It's terrible, right? Names are just disappearing.
Well, that was a Paul W.S. Anderson movie. I'm certainly familiar with Event Horizon.
Yeah, but I interviewed the screenwriter, and he told me a wonderful story about how he, you know, when Philip Eisner, that's right. So Phil told me a wonderful story when he went to London, where they were filming, and He you know, he just gets off the plane. Oh, Mr. Eisner, they need you over in the studio. Oh, okay. So he's pretty knackered. So he gets out of the cab into another cab, and the cab takes him to the studio. He gets out of the cab into a golf cart. The golf cart takes him all around the place. He said, it's freezing, the wind, the rain, I'm tired. And the golf cart pulls up next to these stairs. And he said, I get out of the golf cart and climb the stairs. Just go to the top of the stairs. Climb to the top of the stairs, come in, and he comes out onto a gantry. And the gantry is surrounding, for those familiar with Event Horizon, with the big, the magneto drive the makes the gateway, the big ball inside that room, you know.
Yeah.
And he's looking down at this, and all of a sudden he sees a group of people standing there, and they're making last-minute lighting checks and changes and whatever. And Paul W.S. Anderson looks up and sees Phil standing on the gantry, and he says, "This is all your fault." And it's a great story, you know, but you can imagine, like, being the guy, like, I know there's a lot of writers contributed to the script of Waterworld, like, you know, Peter Rader and David Toohey's credited, and I heard somewhere in the readings and research that Joss Whedon contributed at some point to the script or something like that. But it would be incredible, I think, to have walked onto that atoll set and just, you know, sort of gasp at the enormity, like, wow, this is huge. This is like, you know, this is real. You know, this is like no acting required here. Like, you're there. You're in that world. You're in that moment. Man, I hope that this stuff I'm drinking isn't actually recycled piss, you know. it's absolutely just the scale. Like, they make movies on a big scale today, but we know, because, you know, anyone who loves movies and is interested in how movies are made, we know that there's a good portion of them that are created inside a computer. You know, there's only
nowadays, yeah.
Yeah, there's only partial sets, there's only partial this and partial that. But then, at that time still, there were these massive films like Waterworld, made on a massive, on the biggest scale possible, and with massive sets, and they built the sets, and you were in that environment. And so, it's just like back in the day when there was more animatronics than CGI monsters. And it was the actors, as they've often said in interviews, it was easier to do because you're looking at what you're acting to something. You're not acting to a tennis ball on the top of a stick or something, right?
Right.
You're reacting to a set. You're reacting to the world around you. So it's a lot easier, of course, for them to pull it off when there's that great sort of world encircling them, and you don't have to act, really. You've just got to, like, react to what's going on, you know.
Yeah.
So it's for me, that's always been, when I think of Waterworld, I think of, like, the end of a kind of an era of filmmaking that is, you know, they still, like, obviously they've made bigger films, they've made more expensive films, they've made, you know, films of scope like that, but the way it was made and the style in which it was made, has, you know, isn't done anymore. It's just not done, you know, because all of the variables have changed. You know, from the filmmaking techniques to the technology, it's all very much a different ballgame today as it was then. And, you know, I often get the feeling, I sit and hypothesize sometimes, if Waterworld had been made today, like if it was this summer's big blockbuster, what kind of business would
it would look like? Aquaman, you know, it would look like Aquaman. Aquaman's on water, you know, but it looks,
yeah,
you know, I'm not going to bash Aquaman, but it just looks so artificial, you know, it doesn't look right to me at all. Or even the Meg, you know, I mean, I like the Meg too, but it's just, the entire aesthetic of those movies is just completely alien compared to what Waterworld is, you know.
Yeah.
Just completely, your eyes, you know the difference between real and completely, you know, ghastly, weird special effects. You know, when you look at a transformer or, you know, a digital shark, you know it's there's something really weird about it. You know, the way it moves, it doesn't look natural at all.
Mm.
But I, you know, Waterworld just it stands apart, especially for that time period that it came out in. 95 was a, you know, there were a lot of cool movies that summer, but none of them resembled Waterworld, and to this day, still nothing looks like Waterworld does.
Yeah.
And it tells the kind of story that's never been told on in that setting. You know, it's not a desert. It's not an irradiated nuclear wasteland or urban, you know, ruined city. You know, it's a completely new look for an apocalyptic film.
Yeah. And that's automatically like when most people, I've introduced a few people to the film that sort of like fobbed it off and never bothered. And I said, no, just seriously sit down and watch it. And they do. And they're like, wow, that was so like, I know it's it's going to sound like a pun. It's like a, they go, oh, it was like a really refreshing splash of water. No, but it was on the face. But no, but it, exactly what you said, it's refreshing because it's not a dystopia that is, you know, like I Am Legend or Blade Runner or, you know, Beneath the Planet of the Apes or, you know, it's not a harsh, you know, the wreckage of humanity, you know. It's everything... laid clean, you know, almost biblically, you know, like you can imagine, like I'm not gonna.
Well, I like that it makes its own rules. You know, they create a new language for the movie, even a visual language. It just everything about that movie feels like it's a new syntax of all the cinematic language that we've known up to that point for. What we are expected, what we expect from a post-apocalyptic movie, it creates its own universe, you know, they have their own language, the way they dress, the way they behave, there's a code that people follow, you know, when two people meet out at sea, they have to trade, you know, and everything, even the currency is unique in the movie, everything about the movie is very singular, there's no other movie like it.
Yeah, And the great thing about it too is then there's not a great dearth. You get the feeling if it were made today, they would bog it down with a lot of exposition, like how did this happen, how that happened, and there'd be flashbacks and flash forwards and whatever else. But one of its great strengths is the economy of the storytelling. Like you've just got that you know the Universal logo becomes part of the story at the beginning, you know, the future, the polar ice caps have melted, you know, there's great economy in that, so that, you know, the people who survived have adapted to a new world, you know, and that's it, you know, there's nothing, there's no great flashbacks of like how the seas rose and why they rose and all this sort of stuff. And I also like the fact too that it's obviously a point of almost religious contention in the film. Like you hear that little bit of dialogue where she Jean Triplehorn tells the survivors once they find more survivors later, the ocean the world the world didn't sink, it was covered by the ocean, and they go, that's blasphemy. You know, it wasn't created in a deluge. You know, it wasn't created in a deluge. It was covered by the ocean. You know, and they're like, that's blasphemy, right? And, you know, so there's this great, there's all these different levels at play, which to the casual observer, they don't, you know, if you don't, movies are just like anything. If you don't invest something of yourself going in, and I know some people say, look, oh, well, how do you do that? Right, because they look at me funny, they go, well, how do you do that with, like, King of the Kickboxers or Deathstalker 2 or something like that? And I said, but I still, you know, I still invest myself because, okay, yeah, I love those movies, and I get great enjoyment, and I have a great, you know, history. It's like listening to a song that reminds you of a great time in your life, or the song when you first danced with your wife, or well, that sort of thing. I said, yeah, but I said, I'm still invested, right? And I'm invested for, you know, different reasons. And I said, you know, if you're not invested when watching a picture, you can miss so many of these little subtleties that are put in there. You know, they're not just put in there to throw away. They're put in there to add depth to what you're experiencing. They're adding depth to the world further by telling you, like, okay, this is a very complex society. As stripped down and ripped up and retrofitted as it is, it is a complex world, and they have had to evolve. And you get the feeling that it was all sort of scratched together really quickly, right? But we're seeing the absolute tip of the iceberg. We're seeing, you know, how it's all come. But if you watch it carefully, yeah, you'll see during the film how probably very rushed it was, this new world. Like, everything had to be ripped up and retrofitted, because we don't know how fast the seas rose and how, you know, there's obviously no one left alive except for some of the elders, but they're not saying too much, you know. We don't want anything for it. We just want your seed. you know, no one stays out that long.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, they're pretty tight-lipped, you know. No one stays out that long and turns down a woman. But it's definitely a case of, like, okay, we're not being told anything. So the more careful you watch, the little subtleties, you know, like you said, the languages, there's obviously different languages that are a hybrid of old languages. You know, there's obviously religious connotations. Like you said,
yeah, even Klaus's character is a mutant, and, you know, there's like whispers and like there's mutants out there somewhere, because they shun him once they realize he's a what they call a mutal, you know. So that's even interesting. There's so much going on in this world that we're not seeing, but we get it, you know, because we're seeing exactly the right amount. And that's why I'm saying I wish there were more stories to read. You know, there was a follow-up comic book series that came out some years later, and that was cool, you know, but I would like to see some spin-off novels or something that you know, explores that world, because it's so rich. You know, I mean, luckily, you know, George Miller made a couple of Mad Max movies, and so we've seen more of that world, and it's been expanded. Waterworld, we only got the one. No spin-off, no sequel, no reboot, nothing. Just that's it.
In watching it today, it feels like it was like... I know that we're kind of being conditioned today to see movies as part of, you know, franchises and series of films. But I don't know whether it's because of that or not, but in watching it today, it feels like it'd be one of those movies, if it came out today, that, like, oh, this is the movie that sets up this world, and the next movie's going to be huge. The sequel's going to be twice the size, you know what I mean?
Well, you know, when they've tried that, like with John Carter, or you know, they've tried to do that with some of these movies, and they bomb spectacularly, you know, because they set it up, you know, they assume or they plan out, you know, like a whole franchise before even getting the first movie out, and I think that's actually a mistake doing it that way. I think they should just do the one and see how that goes, you know, like Cameron did Avatar. I don't think he had in his mind, you know, I'm gonna do, you know, 5, 6, 7 movies out of this.
Yeah.
Because that's just crazy to do that, you know. So I think that Waterworld is a very self-contained movie. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And it ends very satisfactorily.
Yeah.
Everything is resolved. It's just you want to see more. You know, it's so good that you want to see more of it.
Mm. Yeah, and I mean, that's another thing too. That's another big difference. Is today we are conditioned to the fact that there are going to be more, and if it does well at the box office, there will be another one. Not so with films back from that time. You know, Waterworld was, you know, I mean, even if it had it done well, would have they have made a sequel? You know, there's a lot to speculate, but most films, there were a lot more films at that time that were self-contained movies, that weren't built to be the spearhead of a franchise or something like that. So, I mean, that's another big difference with the filmmaking then as per now. I mean, now it's almost a given. Like, if it makes over a certain dollar figure, box office-wise, you're pretty much guaranteed there'll be another one, right? Whether it's part of a continuing IP or not, they'll find a way to make a second one, you know. Or they'll bring the whole team back and say, we have to make a sequel because the first one did ridiculous business, right? You know, but not.
I can't even imagine what a second Waterworld movie would look like or feel like, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, they spent so much time and effort and money putting that thing together. It's almost a blessing we didn't get another one, you know. I'm just so thankful that we got the one.
Yeah. You know? Oh, no. Don't think I'm ungrateful, but it's definitely, you know, I mean, certainly if it had been made today, that would be on the cards. They were like, wow, that movie made, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, then we have to do another one. You know, this one will be mostly set on dry land, I think, you know. Because, I mean, you can, you know, playing Monday morning quarterback is easy. Like, okay, the Mariner left and he's got to come back and, you know, it'll be like a revenge western or something like that. Where, you know, Dryland is exploited, and he's like the man with no name who's got to come back and clean up the town, or sail in and you know, he's like Pale Rider or something. But, you know, but no, but I'm personally glad it ends, and ends well. It ends, I mean, the Drifter is an iconic character. It's just like the end of The Searchers, you know. It's not the hearth and the homemaker are not his world. He's destined forever to wander between the winds, like John Wayne at the end of The Searchers. You know, he's that definite archetype character where he's, it's a little bit sad because, you know, the whole film has been him, his arc is like him discovering almost a modicum of humanity or faith in humanity, if you will, you know, because he actually, you get the feeling we'll miss these people that he has gone on this adventure with. But he knows himself well enough, and he knows his creed well enough that he can't, you know, like he's on land, he goes, this place is weird, it doesn't move right, you know, because he's so used to having the waves under feet, so to speak. So, and plus he's, you know, we always forget too that he's not a man, he's a hybrid,
They set up that other male character to sort of be Helen's mate, you know, that the sheriff of the atoll, you know, he comes along for the ride, and I thought that was appropriate. You know, she has somebody to mate with and protect the island with, you know, I don't see the Mariner sticking around for a fist fight, you know, he's ready to move on.
yeah, I mean, it's so much. In that kind of world, just like in George Miller's Mad Max universe, you get the sense that in these kinds of wastelands, the smartest way to stay alive is to be nomadic, and not, you know, don't build a house. Don't, you know, because, like, those places are just, you know, as we see in the opening of the film, those places are just a hive for marauders, basically. Like, wow, look at all this stuff these people have got. Let's burn it all and take it all, and, you know. So, you know, you're kind of smart staying mobile, staying on the move. You know, it's, It really is wonderful. I've spoken on, I went on Michael Cook's Trash Cinema talking it up. I know I'm talking it up again. People think I'm going to sound like a crack record. But this is a really, 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 really cool release. As soon as I heard about it, I was like, oh, this is fantastic. Like, it wasn't Christmas, but it felt like Christmas. All my Christmases have come at once. And this is a great...
Well, it really is a spectacular release. You know, I was really happy that they put all three of the versions on there.
Yeah.
I wasn't even aware of a third one. I knew that there was the longer cut, because that had been released on DVD.
Yeah.
But the third uncensored cut is a very great companion piece to the theatrical version.
Yeah.
I kind of wish there was a version out there that had Mark Isham's score, you know, the original score intended for the movie. I'd be very curious to hear what that sounds like in the movie.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's definitely, just, yeah, you know, I love it when people take such care, and the people behind the restoration or the re-release of films are actual fans of the movie. Like, it's not just a cash grab. Like, oh, let's release this again. And they don't sort of take any care with it. It's a rush job. But when someone goes to all the trouble of really getting some people involved that have a genuine passion for the movie and a genuine, you know, need to, let's celebrate this movie, because it deserves its place in the sun. It's a definite you know, great artifact of a different time in filmmaking and a different time in cinema, and just a wonderful trove of just a rich adventure, like a good old fashioned, you know. I got the feeling that's what people loved about Aquaman this past holiday season, is it wasn't too serious, it wasn't dark and brooding, it was just a fun, rollicking adventure, you know, with a little bit of everything. And Waterworld is exactly that. You know, people might, you know, throw crap on it from great heights, but at its heart, it's just a good old fashioned adventure movie. It's a man on a mission. You know, it's a wonderfully created world. It's a wonderfully created mythology that's there too. You know, albeit in not heavy-handed detail. I mean, it's not Lord of the Rings or anything where there's, you know, appendices and all that sort of shit, but it's definitely a movie which has a lot more on offer if you give it a shot. And I definitely hope, I know the fans will be out in droves to get this release, but I hope people who, listening to this, and people that are following this release as it gets ready to be released, definitely give it a shot and have a look at the film in all of its glory. And I really can't wait to see Daniel's documentary. From all accounts, it's wonderful. You've watched it, have you?
Oh yeah, yeah, it really is. They didn't get Costner or Triplehorn or Tina Majorino to come on camera. You know,
yeah.
they used archival interviews for
right,
that.
Right. Yeah.
Other than that, they got everybody else.
Yeah.
Got everybody else.
That's great. Well, I did briefly spoke to Daniel. I'm hoping to do a little chat with him, but he got Kevin Reynolds' blessing. Kevin Reynolds watched it and was happy, which is a huge thing. You know, and unfortunately, some of the great cast members aren't with us anymore. Dennis is of course gone, and Michael Jeter, who was a marvelous character actor, and you know, I said to him, I said, did you go after Jack Black? And he said, and for a minute there he goes, why? And I was like, come on, think about it, Jack Black.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, oh shit, yeah. No. And I said, yeah, but it would have been interesting, right? Because that was like one of his first roles in film ever. And he plays the, you know, he's the pilot of the, you know, the skyboat.
Yeah.
You know, as they call it. But no, wonderful, wonderful film. And I'm eagerly anticipating it getting into my hot little hands, which it's not here yet. But it's coming. It's on its way. But it's been really cool. Fabulous to talk to you, David, this morning on Podcasting Softly. I guess give a plug to your books. You're an author of some wonderful books. Tell people where they can get your literature.
Sure, no problem. World Gone Wild, Survivor's Guide to Post-Apocalyptic Movies is my attempt to put all post-apocalyptic movies and TV shows and anime, cartoons, and everything that deals with the end of the world under one roof up to the time that it was published. And that can be found anywhere. Most people buy it from Amazon. And then there's my second one, The Good, the Tough, and the Deadly, Action Movies and Stars, which deals with men and women who crossed over from the world of martial arts, sports, wrestling, or whatever avenue they were in professionally that involved their physicality. They crossed over into movies and became action stars. So, and that's a huge book, a massive undertaking. That book covers something like 1,200 or 1,300 movies, and I interviewed something like 70 action stars and filmmakers. So yeah, you know, both books are a lot of fun, and they both can be purchased on Amazon or wherever, and I'm easy to find on Facebook or on Twitter. Just, you know, keep your eyes out for that stuff if you're into it. Thank you, Kent. I appreciate the time that you took to talk to me. I appreciate it. Thank you.
That's awesome, mate. My guest, David J. Moore, wonderful man, wonderful author. He's a contributor to the Arrow release of Waterworld. Fantastic Blu-ray release. Got lots and lots of features. Check it out. It's got a wonderful booklet with an essay written by my guest. It's got reproductions of lobby cards. It's got a wonderful documentary by Daniel Griffith. It's got the three versions of the film. It's Waterworld. You may love it, you may hate it. We love it. Check it out. This has been Kent Hill for Podcasting Them Softly.